You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at sevillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Daniels. Virginia House of Delegates members Rob Bell and David Toscano provided their perspectives on issues that came before the 2009 legislature at the May 13, 2009 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. Our podcast is entitled The 2009 General Assembly Session. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. Today's program was moderated by SSV board member Jim Perkins.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senior Statesmen of Virginia's meeting for this month. We are pleased to have the venue here at the Senior Center. Our host has been very gracious with these facilities, and we've really enjoyed them over the past months, and we intend to keep them here. So plan to be here for the next meeting as well, which will be in June, and then we'll skip July. Peter Thompson is our host, and he would like to welcome you, I think.
Thank you, Jim, and thank you, everybody, for coming. I am Peter Thompson. I have the great pleasure of serving as the executive director here at the Senior Center and to welcome you. So welcome Senior Center members, Senior Statesmen members, people that are both guests, and particularly welcome our delegates that cover our area. I was talking to someone just a minute ago and reminded about how much I personally, as a citizen of this community, appreciate the work that David and Rob do. I can't imagine how much time it puts in just to be knowledgeable about all these topics. I can't imagine how many midnight calls and 24-hour-a-day emails they get. They're accountable for a lot of actions, some beyond their control. It's often thankless work, and I don't know exactly what the remuneration is, but it can't add up to very much more than pennies an hour for the amount of time they put in. So personally, I thank them both for all that they do to make Albemarle County and Charlottesville and our Commonwealth of Virginia better. I have a lot of respect for both these gentlemen. And you know, anybody in the room, and you're all politically savvy folks, probably disagree with one or the other of them, because it's been known to happen occasionally that they don't agree upon issues. So while you may personally disagree with either one of them at any time, I think everybody in our community respects the work they do. They put in yeoman's hours. I think they're both very good at listening to community issues, and even when I disagree with one or the other, I have a lot of respect for how they go about their decision making. And the Senior Center again welcomes you and thanks you for everything you do. Thanks the Senior Statesmen for having their events here. It's very much aligned with what the Senior Center's purpose is, to help seniors stay involved and to be civically engaged and to not tell you how to think or how to act or how to vote, but just to give you opportunities for information for you to make the best decisions for you and for our community. So we're very proud to be affiliated with this and hope it continues to work out, not just this year but beyond. And on behalf of everybody at our Senior Center community, welcome, thank you, and enjoy the show. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Peter. In presenting our delegates, it usually is noted that they are in their introduction that there is no need to introduce them because everybody knows who they are and it goes without saying. However, it's true, but I think that we should recognize these people for the great efforts that they have put forth, and they deserve recognition for their outstanding contributions to our community and the Commonwealth of Virginia. So I would like to take just a little time to give some recognition for the hard work and the buildup that has brought these two fine gentlemen to us today. Rob Bell is the representative, the delegate from the 58th House District. He has been the delegate since 2001, and that is the 58th District is the county of Greene, parts of Albemarle, Fluvanna, and Orange counties. And he served as a state prosecutor for 5 years. He's an honors graduate of the University of Virginia and the University of Virginia Law School. Rob has written laws that crack down on drunk driving, and he was named the 2005 Outstanding Legislator by Mothers Against Drunk Driving here in the state of Virginia. He's also interested in school safety. In recent years, he has written laws to ban criminal sex offenders from school property during school hours, and to require additional background checks on school personnel And in 2008, Rob helped overhaul Virginia's mental health laws in light of the tragedy that was suffered at Virginia Tech. Rob has been an Eagle Scout and was an active volunteer with the Boy Scouts and with public schools prior to his election in 2001. Rob, his wife Jessica, and their children Robbie and Evelyn live in Albemarle County. So please welcome Rob Bell.
It's a honor and a pleasure to be back before you again. I think that we have done this at least once a year, probably twice a year, some years, to come before this group, and it always has good questions. It's not as sort of mean and partisan as some other groups we go before, and I always appreciate hearing a chance to hear y'all speak, especially not just on senior issues, but issues before our area. I represent what most people would call the suburbs of Charlottesville, but not the city. So I have Albemarle County, Greene County, the Lake Monticello part of Fluvanna, and even the Barboursville part of Orange County. And my seat is a famous seat. It's the seat that Thomas Jefferson had back many, many years ago. More recently, people like Paul Harris have sat in this seat. And so it's an honor just to have a seat. Anytime you're on the same list as Thomas Jefferson, it's a pretty big privilege. Our job is part-time. It might surprise you to know that we all have to have, David is actually my landlord. We are both lawyers, and we both have to have another job. And I don't know if you were working earlier today. Okay, so both of us have done work earlier today, and when we're done today, we'll go back to the other job. The pay is consistent with a part-time job, and so all of us who have families have to also work a second job. The legislature is also part-time in that we only meet for part of the year, and so we have finished our session for 2008. We will typically meet for 45 days, so we go down in early January, we stay through the middle of March, and we work on our laws, then we give them all to the governor. He takes a few weeks to look at them, and then he sends them back to us, and we come down one day. It's called the veto session day, and we take up all of his vetoes and his amendments and either pass them, reject them, or move on. But there will be no more, barring a special session or something unusual, there will be no more sessions for this group of delegates. We'll wait until the election, and the new delegates will come in 2009. Both David and I are up for election this year. This was the session we just finished is the topic of our talk today and just state policies, but the session we just finished was dominated by the budget. It's no surprise to anybody who is aware of the economic difficulties the country is having that the state's budget tracks personal budgets. And so when people are doing well, their incomes rise, they buy cars and houses, the sales tax is high. When people are pulling back like they are now, it's very quickly reflected in the state budget. And so what we came in, we have a two-year budget, and we kind of try to figure out what we think the budget's going to be for 2 years. This was the year that we adjust based on, we hope, more money coming in, or in this case, much less money coming in. And so all of the cuts that you've heard about were because we thought there would be modest growth in the budget. And as modest as we weren't near modest enough. And it turns out the budget actually shrank this year for only the third time in 50 years. What that means is all of the budgetary programs had pressure to either make cuts or, if they were really lucky, stay even. That was about the two choices for most of the budget programs, although you'll hear over the course of the day about a handful of programs that we were able to find some money for. It also affects other bills, and so you might think that that's not a budget item, this idea that you had or that you heard of, but if it costs some money to implement it. So, for instance, a few years ago, we increased the penalties for drunk drivers. They have to go to jail for longer. That doesn't sound like a budget bill, but it costs some money to put someone in jail. And so what that bill did is that ended up, that kind of, bills like that had a hard time passing this year. There were some particular bills of interest to seniors that I worked on, and then some other bills that passed that might be of interest to seniors. I had a bill this year that came from a terrible incident at a local assisted living facility where an elderly lady developed a pressure sore. And that's what they used to call bed sores, but now they're called pressure sores. And she developed sepsis, and ultimately it killed her. And the family members came to me and said, this is not something that should be happening in the modern age at an assisted living facility in Albemarle County. We should have a law that tells people about it. Because if you tell people about it, these facilities will do a better job. If it's not done in the dark and in secret, they'll figure it out. And so we had a bill, and in fact, it was such a good idea that the governor's people said, you know, we can make this happen faster than a new law. A new law means it takes effect in July, and then it takes some regulations going into effect. It'll take a whole year and a half if you write the new law. Let's just do it right now. Let's change the regs and have it happen right now. And so we had a meeting down in Richmond, and we agreed to do it in February, and it's already taken place. So it's already true now that if you have someone who has a bad pressure sore event at an assisted living facility, they will have to report it. And again, we hope that that'll lead to fewer pressure sores. The second bill was an offshoot of the mental health reform we did last year. There was a very complicated issue called advanced medical directives. Now, I hope all of you have at least heard of these before, but an advanced medical directive is how you give some guidance to your family members of what to do if you're not capable of telling them about your health care needs. Now, we've had these for years, and they're called end-of-life care or advanced medical directives. there's another term that I'm forgetting, but the idea of most people already know is that if I'm in a coma, this is what I want to have happen to me. Well, the mentally ill and also people with Alzheimer's said, you know, we are in a position to give some guidance, but our guidance isn't very good. We're telling the doctors not to give me that medication or not to put me in that facility when, in fact, that's what I really need. And so we wanted to set up a system where you could, when you're of right mind, set up an advance directive that would carry through to a point later on when you might be having some trouble. And that proved to be harder than you might think because, of course, you want to be able to change advance directives if you are of right mind. And so the question was, how can we let you change them when you're doing okay, but how can we still tell your doctors what to do when you're having a hard time? And so I'm happy to talk about that for hours and hours. It's an interesting intellectual enterprise. We had lots of help from UVA's law professor, Richard Bonney. That's mostly intended for mentally ill, but will also be directly helpful for seniors who want to do Alzheimer's advanced directives. The third is not directly targeting seniors, but it's certainly something that interests seniors. We have expanded the identity theft law in Virginia this year. It was a bill that I did. And most of you know what identity theft means, but it means someone steals your Social Security number, steals your birthday, starts to take out credit cards, they can take out mortgages. What prompted this bill was someone took out a student loan in someone else's name. And it turns out that wasn't covered. Whoever thought you could do that? And the person that did that was not prosecuted for identity theft. And we said, gosh, that's terrible. Obviously, they made a hash of somebody else's credit. Let's make that an identity theft bill. And so that was one of the laws that passed this year. I did some other bills involving public safety about sexual assault, child pornography, some other things. I'll be happy to talk about them if they interest you. But I'd like to go ahead and stop here, let Dave talk, and then take as many questions as we can. Thanks again for coming.
Thank you much, Rob. Our delegate from the 57th House District is David Toscano. He represents the city of Charlottesville and part of Albemarle County, and he was elected to his first term in the Virginia House of Delegates in 2005. He has a bachelor's degree from Colgate. From Boston College, he got his PhD and a law degree from the University of Virginia. He's taught at various colleges and universities, including Boston College, University of Maryland, Piedmont, and the University of Virginia, and JMU, James Madison. He's an attorney with Buck, Toscano, and Tereskers. And David served on the Charlottesville City Council, which you may remember, from 1990 to 2002, and he was the mayor during part of that term, 1994-1996. David serves on the Courts of Justice, Transportation, and Science and Technology Committees in the House of Delegates, and he's also a member of the Disability Commission, the Joint Commission to Study Math, Science, and Technology Education in the Commonwealth. And he's also in the Joint Subcommittee to Study Land Use Tools in the Commonwealth. He's a member of the United Way Board and the Chamber of Commerce, and David is a resident of the city where he lives with his wife, Nancy, and their son, Matthew. We're going to have David give his presentation, and then we're going to have questions. Did you pass out cards? Would you have cards to everybody so that you could ask your questions with a card and we can do them? Nope. Okay, well, we'll get you some more cards. Just raise your hand and we'll get them. So please welcome David Toscano.
Thank you. It's a great honor to be here. It's wonderful to be with my colleague, Mr. Bell. You know, we have this traveling road show that starts after the session. You know, when we get into the campaign, we're not running against each other, so we don't see as much of each other, but it's always good to be here, and it's always great to be at this event. You know, in my, I've been an attorney now, I think 25 years, but I remember when I first came to Charlottesville, I came here as a young whippersnapper, sociology PhD professor, and it was a while ago, it was almost 30 years ago, and I walked into the sociology department, and I was given a couple of lessons by somebody in this room who will not be identified by me unless she raises her hand. She may or may not remember the lesson she gave me, but I remember very distinctly because I had this notion that, because I was a PhD, I should be called Dr. Toscano. Well, she very quickly discouraged me from that notion, and she said, you know, Mr. Toscano, when you're here at the university, you're a professor, but you're always called Mr. And Mr. Jefferson would have liked it that way. And then I asked her, well, you know, show me, tell me a little bit about the campus here. Oh, boy, did I walk in with it? And she said to me, yeah, it's never the campus, always the grounds. And I never forgot that. And who would think that 30 years later I'd be standing here as really one of the successors to Thomas Jefferson's seat? You know, Jefferson couldn't have just one successor. He actually has four successors. When Jefferson represented this area, he represented Albemarle County, including this little hamlet called Charlottesville. It wasn't a city then. There are also two other folks who have some portions of Albemarle, Delegate Landis and Delegate Abbott. So, you know, we're all in good company. We could never fill the shoes by ourselves, so we got to fill them together, and he had a pretty big shoes. I've come with lots of little exhibits, okay? So this is some of the fun stuff we do down the General Assembly. All right, can everybody see this? Can everybody tell me what this is? Laundry, well, that's a good start. But it has, oh, well, you're getting close. It has a technical name. This is called a wind energy drying device. And there was a bill introduced in the General Assembly this year. It came out of the Senate. And it had to do with wind energy drying devices. That was the name of the bill. And the notion that homeowners associations could no longer prohibit them from being erected on a person's property. Well, that bill sailed out of the Senate. And here it comes over to the House. And this, as you know, in the General Assembly, in order for the bill to be passed, it's got to be passed by both houses, both chambers, go to the governor and be signed. Well, you know, one house, one chamber could say yes, one says no, the bill dies. Well, the Senate thought really well of this bill. 40-0 comes out to the House. Even got to the House floor. Well, on the House floor, it died because people decided, well, we're not going to do that. So that was one bill that went down the drain, but I think it's kind of interesting to see some of the things we deal with. Okay, here's another one. Delegate Bell knows about this one. All right, this is an Eastern box turtle or something like that. Here is another. This could have been your state reptile under a bill that came over from the Senate again. You know, who says the Senate is the superior body, right? Comes over from the Senate 40-0. This one got out of House committee, got to the House floor. Well, when it got out of onto the House floor, and very rarely are bills killed on the floor, you know, but it got to the House floor, and an elderly delegate from Frank Hargrove, I think he's the oldest delegate, he must be in his 80s, starts asking questions. Well, it finds out that the technical legal term for this thing is called a terrapin something. Well, that implicated all the Maryland analogies, and people didn't like that. Well, it's actually called Eastern Carolina's terrapin. Well, there's Carolina for you, and that bill's in trouble. And then they found out it was the state reptile of Carolina, and then the final death knell of the bill was the answer to the question of what happens when this thing gets scared. Well, he puts his head in a shell. That was the end of that bill. So, as you could see, we do occasionally have some fun in the House of Delegates. That being said, this session was all about money and about the budget. And as many of you know, when you were reading the papers, when we started down the road to Richmond toward the end of December, we were facing a budget shortfall of about $2.9 billion. The governor had acted in early December with a proposal to modify our two-year budget to take account of the fact that we had this shortfall. It wasn't going to be enough money. And he had to make some recommendations on some pretty strong cuts, including cuts to K-12 education, which was the first time during all the cuts that have been made that K-12 was going to be affected. There were also some pretty big cuts for higher education, I think about 15%. The sheriffs were and a lot of public safety were targeted for a 7% cut. There were some big cuts all across the board. Well, by the time we start session in mid-January, people are predicting that the budget shortfall is not going to be 2.9, but maybe 3.5 billion. So now we've got more problems. Now, fortunately, we had a new president at that time and a new Congress, And that Congress and that president passed what's called a stimulus package. And that package sent money to states around the country. Virginia was actually the first state in the country to pass a budget in the aftermath of the stimulus package. And let me tell you, you could say what you want about the stimulus package. I've got concerns long term about how we're going to pay for it all. But without the money coming in January and February to the Commonwealth of Virginia, we would not have gotten a balanced budget unless you wanted to cut about 7,000 state employees, make cuts, further cuts in aid to localities, cut sheriff's budgets, cut K through 12, cut higher ed, and a whole host of other things. So we've got problems if the economy doesn't improve, but we were going to have bigger problems if we didn't accept that stimulus money. And now we're finding we got some more challenges because, as Delegate Bell said, the revenues aren't keeping pace. The governor's probably going to have to make some further cuts. So that was the big story of the General Assembly. I had a whole bunch of bills that got considered. I was pretty lucky this term. A lot of them got passed. Some of them didn't. We can talk about those bills. They ran the gamut from energy to foster care initiatives. But I've taken almost 10 minutes, so that's too long. And we're going to open it up for questions at this point. Thank you again for having me here.
Thank you very much, David and Rob. We're going to take these questions by the cards today because we need to get this on the podcast, and so we can make sure that we get the proper question recorded and the answers from our delegates. So does anybody have a question that they've written out? Here comes Bill. Okay, this can be addressed by either of you. At the present time, Albemarle County pays a great deal of money to the city of Charlottesville. It is my understanding that this agreement was made to stop having the city, what is that, a fixed land from, get land from the county. And can the county stop this payment, and will a new law need to be written to address this?
I'm in a unique position because I represented the city for 12 years on the city council, and now I got both jurisdictions, so that's a wonderful position to be in. I was not on the council that negotiated the revenue sharing agreement. That was negotiated in the early 80s. At the time that cities had the ability to annex land, and the city was essentially threatening to annex land and a lot of land in Albemarle County. The projections were that the city might try to take land all the way out 29, all the way to the Rivanna. I mean, you can imagine right now the city line stops at the Golden Corral, and the Golden Corral is in the city. So for those of you who want to pay tax dollars and go out to either the Golden Corral, the sales tax comes to the city. Then there's the line, and then imagine going all the way out 29. Now, 29 didn't look anything like it does now. I mean, there were a lot of undeveloped spots on 29, but it is a very valuable corridor, and one might imagine what that would mean if the city had annexed that far at that time. It would probably mean a couple things. The biggest thing would be that you would have a lot more sprawl and commercial development in Albemarle County. So one good thing about the revenue sharing agreement, it allows the county to further concentrate its growth in areas which are probably more appropriate and can help preserve the rural parts of the county. Now, this was a contract, and generally speaking, governments don't overturn contracts that have been negotiated openly and without duress. And my guess is that this contract probably stays as it is. The contract has a formula associated with it, and it's a formula that is called revenue sharing. What happens is the formula is applied to the growth in the increase in sales tax in both jurisdictions and then allocated to whatever jurisdiction is not making out as well. So it was to share in the revenues. It happens that Charlottesville has been the beneficiary of that contract for many, many years. there is a cap on what the city can receive every year, and that a cap is essentially 10 cents on the real estate tax rate in the county. Every year, the formula generates a number that is much higher than that cap. So the county doesn't pay that much higher amount, it pays the lower amount, the cap. A lot of people are concerned about this long term. If you look at the number, it's a pretty large number. But it was the agreement that was struck at the time. Now, for me, I think the county and the city can go back to the table and think about creative ways to deal with the revenue sharing issue. There are ways you could do it. You could consolidate departments. You could merge services. You might even provide for some common development areas where both jurisdictions would share in the revenue. So far, there hasn't been the political will to do that. It requires the city and the county to both come to the table. Maybe they will, and if they do, we can go back to the General Assembly and get whatever legislative authority needs to be gotten to allow them to do what they want to do. And I think both of us would be interested in doing that.
Is that too long?
Well, I'm not in the same sort of awkward position that Dave is in because I don't represent the city. And I think it's fair to say that of the people that made the deal, none of the politicians who signed this contract are in a position of authority anymore. I don't know how. When was it signed, Dave? It's been a whole generation of people have come and gone since then. And the question is whether this deal, which was struck, in the early 80s, will forever bind county taxpayers to pay a significant part of their tax dollars over to the city. And right now, the city has no interest or intention of ever renegotiating because why would they? I mean, they're getting it all, and there's no, in terms of bringing everybody to the table, there's no, I think, incentives for them to do so. At some point, and if we're not there yet, I can see it from here, I think it's going to come time for everybody to say that deal was struck under a set of laws that no longer exist. The city can no longer annex parts of the county. I mean, we just, in fact, this year, we extended the annexation moratorium, they call it, to 2018. So every other city in the Commonwealth would love to annex parts of the nearby counties, and they can't. City of Charlottesville can't either because they have this agreement over the top of the law, but the law right now says they can't. And so what you have is essentially the county has a very, very bad deal. They are paying for something that no other county in the Commonwealth has to pay for, which is a prohibition on annexation. I think it's something we ought to look at. I think that if the city and county can come together and come up with some of the things Dave is describing, that's a good idea. And that would be a way to deal with this without having someone down in Richmond sort of take a look at this. But I think over time, and maybe it's not 2009, maybe we wait for the 30-year anniversary in 2011. Maybe we pick a date and we say, listen, this has had a good run. It's been a long, long time where the city has taken the benefit of this agreement. But I think we need to look at it again. Right now, a substantial part of the county tax revenues are given directly to the city to spend on whatever they choose. And I think that, as the county has continued to grow and as these communities have become more sophisticated and complicated, I think we need to relook at that. Thank you.
Could I follow up on one, just so people understand how it also works and how it was passed? The other thing people ought to remember, this was not just an agreement between the county board and the city council. This was approved by a referendum in both the city and the county. So it wasn't just smoke-filled rooms making a deal. It was approved by voter referendum.
Excuse me. The next question has to deal with the federal stimulus money to extend unemployment compensation. And the last-minute vote to reject that, in the opinion of this person, was wrong. That is that not only for unemployment, but for everyone else in the economy as well. There's two questions. Another person wrote, would you give us your explanation of your vote on the federal forms for unemployment, and will you call for a special session to reverse that decision?
And I voted differently. Do you want to go first? Or?
I went left.
Okay. No, I voted against it. Dave voted for it, and so you get to hear both sides of this. In terms of the unemployment benefit program, we received several opportunities to take stimulus money, and I'll tell you what they were. The first was we extended, and this was not part of the stimulus package, this is just something we did. We extended the unemployment benefits from 26 weeks to 59 weeks. We more than doubled them. So if you are unemployed and you qualify for unemployment benefits, we doubled the length of time you can get them because we were afraid that 26 weeks wasn't long enough and you might still need them at the end of 26 weeks. The second was that the stimulus package included an opportunity to pay for part of the healthcare benefits. Now, I don't know how many people in this room are still sort of, you know, everyday working people and have to worry about their health insurance benefits in the same way. But right now, if you lose your job, one of the fears is, yes, you're allowed to extend your health insurance through a program called COBRA, but you can't afford it. You don't have your job, and it's very expensive to pay the share of COBRA. And so this program would have allowed the government to pay about two-thirds of that for the period in which you were unemployed. And that was stimulus money, and it ran out when the stimulus money ran out. It was a program that would end. The third was we were going to increase, we have a scheduled increase in who gets to qualify for unemployment benefits. It's not everyday part-time employees. You have to earn $2,700 a quarter just by the schedule. That was going to go up to $3,000. We held off on that. We said, although it will cost some money, we're going to keep it at $2,700 a quarter so that more people can qualify. So we did increase the number of people that could qualify. We did extend the length of time that the benefits would run, and we did take stimulus money to pay for health insurance benefits, because when that money runs out, that will go away. Now, we did reject some federal money. Let me tell you why. The federal money that we rejected required Virginia to change its permanent laws. Now, that may not sound like much, but let me explain. The permanent laws of the Commonwealth are the everyday laws that we passed to say what does and doesn't happen in the unemployment benefits program. And the concern, my concern, was that when the money ran out, this was a one-time federal spending program. When the money ran out, the law would still be there, and we would have to raise taxes on employers after the money ran out. I mean, it was going to increase the cost for the program. The money was not going to cover it forever. And more than that, the stimulus package required this. They could have said, you can end this program when the money runs out. They could have said, it's called a reenactment clause. They said, you'll have to vote for it again to make it stay in place. They could have a sunset, which says after a certain date, it goes away. That's not what it said. It said, you have to make it a change in permanent law. Well, that was and this was from the Department of Labor regulations for that. That was something we didn't want to do. If you raise taxes on employers, it makes it harder for people to find jobs. It raises the cost of hiring people. And we said, if you will let us tie it to the money that you're giving us, that's one thing. But if you're going to make us change Virginia's permanent laws, make it harder for employers to hire people, that's not something we're willing to do, even for the money that you're offering us. And so I voted against that one part of the stimulus package.
And I voted for that part of the stimulus package. And let me tell you why. First, we know things are rough in the country and rough in Virginia. And the way it works with unemployment insurance in Virginia, well, first of all, people should know that we have one of the lowest benefit programs of all the states in the country. And I think it's certainly among the five lowest, maybe among the three lowest. We work through an unemployment compensation insurance trust fund. That fund is funded by contributions made by employers. Everybody kicks in together and they essentially share the risk, so that when somebody becomes unemployed, the money comes out to pay for their benefits during the time they receive them. It's very clear that the unemployment trust fund is going to run out of money. The question is when, and what happens when that occurs, because it's got to be replenished. And it's going to be replenished because employers are going to be asked to pay more money. That's going to happen independent of whether we receive this $125 million. Part of the rationale for taking the $125 million was that we could delay the imposition of additional fees on employers, and hopefully the economy would improve and we'd be a little better off. It is true that we would have to make some permanent changes in how we provide benefits. And that's what gave a lot of people heartburn, because they were concerned that this would be permanent. Now, you know, you can always change the law, but, you know, I will acknowledge this, that if you make those changes, it's going to be hard to undo them. So I understand that position. But my view was that we could help a lot of people who were in need, and we could help stabilize that insurance trust fund. And frankly, I think we need to modernize some of our unemployment benefits programs. So I didn't have any problem at all voting for it. The other thing I might say is that the projections were that even if these permanent changes remained in effect, the highest per employee cost that would be additionally imposed, and that's the highest, would be somewhere about $4 per person per year, per employee per year. to me, that didn't seem to be that big of a risk for all of the folks that we could help. And we're talking not just about people who are now unemployed, but people who are potentially unemployed who might not otherwise be able to qualify for benefits. So there's an honest difference of opinion. You know, we passed, it's been a long time ago that we accepted the notion that the federal government ought to be able to attach strings to money that they send to the states. We passed that, we went over that bridge a long time ago. So the question then is, should we accept this money? Should we accept these changes to help those people who could be helped? And that's why I voted for it.
The next question is about budgets and cuts. Does the state of Virginia need air lanes? And this is what is meant by air lanes. That's what I read here. Airplanes, maybe? I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I didn't read that correctly. My mistake. Airplanes. And what purpose do they serve? And second question that this person asks is, why don't we drill offshore of Virginia? Two different questions.
We were having a little consult here about whether the governor owns an airplane. Bipartisan. I don't know. We don't know if the governor... And the governor does have access to a helicopter, because I've seen him use it. Now, should we have airplanes? I don't know the answer. I can tell you that you know, when you're talking about a budget as big as ours, you know, you want to find places where you can cut wherever you can find them. But an airplane, I don't know how much that is. So I'm sorry, I don't have the answer to the question. Governor's got to get around. And sometimes, you know how big the state of Virginia is? It's hard to drive all those miles. Poor Cree. Yeah. He put, 300,000 miles on his Explorer. But let me not be flip about it. Offshore drilling. You know, I think we need to look at all alternatives for generating of energy. I'm a little bit worried about offshore drilling, primarily because the implications for the military operations off the coast. Beyond that, it's not clear how much what can be realized from it. I don't know if you've seen the most recent estimate. There, the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, which has nothing to do with the University of Virginia, I would classify it kind of as a conservative think tank, really recently issued a report, and they weren't even clear on how much gas and oil could come off from offshore drilling. So I'm a little suspect. I think we need to keep all options in play. If you can do it safely without compromising the military operations and without throwing oil onto the beaches of Virginia Beach, you know, then I think we should do it. Natural gas is probably a little less dangerous, probably has a little more possibility for a benefit than drilling for oil off the coast of Virginia. If we're going to put something off the coast of Virginia, we should put wind farms, because they generate a lot of electricity. And of all the places in Virginia which could generate that kind of wind, it would be off the coast. And we know we can put them in places that don't impinge on military operations.
I'm not aware if we have a plane either. I'll be a little stronger, though. If we do, we shouldn't have one. I remember the only reference I can recall about the governor's helicopter locally, I'm not going to say anything else if nobody else remembers, but it wasn't particularly good either. There are some members down in Southwest Virginia that take a plane from Richmond home every weekend, but to my knowledge, that's a private charter. And I think the Virginia Air Guard has some old military planes, but I thought those were on lease. I don't think we own those, but we actually have pilots over in Iraq. I didn't know this, but they get called up, I gather, one by one. But some of our guys that are in our version of the Virginia Guard apparently fly. That's about all I know. I agree with Dave. I think that we should certainly, and I'll maybe be a little more positive, I do think we absolutely should study offshore drilling. If the fuel is there and we can do it safely, we should go after it. I think that from what I've seen, I'm no expert, natural gas does seem to be more promising than oil off the shore. But we should also look at, wind farms, not only off the shore, but certainly we have plenty of high mountains that have the wind. That's a renewable resource we could probably use. But I think we should certainly use that. We should not foreclose that as a way to deal with our energy problems. Thank you.
The next question is, directed to both of you. There are two questions, but they're related. What legislation did you introduce specifically to benefit seniors during the past 2 years, and what legislation will you introduce to benefit seniors in the next sessions if you're elected?
I glanced on these briefly when I started. Let me go through them again, and then if any of them catch your fancy, I think we've got a small enough crowd, you could just ask for a follow-up. The pressure sores bill, while I suppose it affects a small number of people in hospitals, really is about seniors in nursing homes and assisted living facilities. That's where you have people with long-term, lengthy stays where pressure sores become an issue. If you're a young person and you're out of bed in 3 days or in rehab or something, it just doesn't come up. And the problem with a pressure sore is that if it's not addressed quickly, first off, it gets worse and worse. Second off, it can lead to sepsis, and sepsis is what can kill you. And so the local person, I won't tell you her name, but the local person whose grandmother had this issue died. She was taken to the hospital. By the time they got to the hospital, it was too late, and the sepsis had set in. And that bill, I think, I'm hopeful, will lead to fewer pressure sores at assisted living facilities in Virginia. Because once, it's called sunshine, but once you put sunshine on these problems, once they have to tell you how many they have and how many people had injuries or died from them, they'll fix it. They have to. No one will go to an assisted living facility that has a really bad pressure sore record. And so we're certainly hopeful that the new regs that come in will fix that. The second thing, again, is this issue about advanced medical directives. I would hope, or I would encourage everyone in this room to, at some point in the next few weeks, fill out an advanced directives. And there's forms. You don't have to go to a lawyer. They're very easy to do. And all it does is it says, if I have the following problems, here's what I want you to do. I don't want you to, and the usual language is, I don't want you to resuscitate me, or I don't want you to put me on machines, or you can do those two things, but I don't want you to feed me through a tube, or you could do those three things, and there's a blank that says, or anything else, and you can put whatever specific regulations you want. Please keep me alive until my kids can get there, but after that, I don't want to be kept alive artificially, or I want the following religious assistance when I'm in extremis. The new law, the reason it affects seniors in particular, though, is this Alzheimer's issue. The most advanced directives at any time, you can change them. So right now you say, I don't want to be resuscitated, but a week from now you say you do. You just go in and scratch that out and fill out another one. The problem with people who have Alzheimer's, again, is that they might tell you something now that doesn't make sense. Excuse me, they might say something now that makes sense, but when they're in the advanced Alzheimer's like my grandmother was, it just isn't making sense anymore. And if you wanted to bind something, it's called over-protest. If you want to give somebody care over their protest, you got to have a very particular advanced directive. You got to be real clear what you're doing. And with the way that if you read it, what we passed, you'll see that it says, even if I later tell you no, I want you to give me this medication. And we've got all sorts of exceptions for it can't be life-threatening, can't be life-changing. But this is me of right mind giving you some advice about what I want you to do down the road. Please do it. Again, that was largely came out of the mental health reform. So it didn't start as a seniors bill, but boy, halfway through it, all the Alzheimer's groups got interested and said, this is something that we can really work with. And so that was something else that we did. We've had other bills involving nursing homes and assisted living facilities come up, but those are two that come to mind. Thank you.
I don't know if I can say that I can point to a bill that's, I don't know what a bill would be that would be directly related to seniors, because I think all these bills have ramifications for every population group in the society. I didn't offer any tax benefit bills that would be targeted explicitly to seniors, I guess, if that's the question. There are a couple of bills there was one bill specifically that I worked on that has implications for seniors, particularly in terms of transportation. That's the bill that enables Charlottesville and Albemarle to create a regional transportation authority that will help, hopefully, the system, the public transportation system, run more efficiently, potentially help extend operations into the county more so that more people can benefit by those operations and don't always have to take a car. It's up now to the city and the county to decide whether they want to do this or not. It'll be up there, be their choice. They ask for the legislation, we got it passed, and then they got to figure out if they want to do anything about it. Beyond that, I worked on a project this spring I think does have implications for transportation for seniors, and that is the extra train that Amtrak's going to put on beginning in October that will run out of D.C. every day, well, actually starts in Lynchburg every day, runs through Charlottesville, picks up passengers in Charlottesville, goes to D.C., comes back in from D.C. that evening. And that was very interesting. You know, this was a bipartisan effort, and Delegate Bell signed a letter that went to the governor, Delegate Scott from Madison, and, of course, Delegate Valentine from Lynchburg. But it wouldn't have happened without Governor Kaine. I mean, he took a real keen interest in this. He helped push it through. And now it's going to happen. It's a three-year pilot, and we're going to see how it works. If a lot of people try take that train, you know, there's a good chance it'll continue after those 3 years. If a lot of people don't take it, that's the end of it. But we're going to have to create a grid system related to public transportation and rail transportation in this country if we're going to wean ourselves from the dependence on foreign oil that we have. It costs money. It's not easy to start a train. You know, this notion that somehow we can get a train from Crozet to Charlottesville, it's a nice notion. It costs a ton of money. And so there's a pretty substantial investment by the state in this train. And I was pleased to work on it. It was really nice to see it's going to happen.
Did you want to follow on, Rob?
I was just thinking of issues that might be. This is not a bill that David or I did, but it certainly would be of interest to seniors. We passed a new constitutional amendment. And when I say we, I think everybody voted for it. I don't think it was, if it wasn't unanimous, it was very close. But it would allow localities to give additional exemptions for property taxes to people over 65. Now, it's two groups, disabled and people over 60, excuse me, or people, I blew it, disabled or over 65. So it would be, if you are disabled, of course, you would qualify, but also just be anybody over 65. And the question would be, can they waive income requirements? Because right now, for them to give a property tax break, it has to be tied to income, and frankly, it's pretty modest. It's very few people that take advantage of that. This would allow a locality to significantly expand it. And the goal, of course, is we're all aware that people on fixed incomes are particularly, or are especially hit by property tax increases. So as assessments go up, if you're working, you can work a little harder, work a little longer, try to make up that money that you just lost. But boy, if you knock on doors, you hear from people that say, look, I can't increase my income. It's a fixed income, and my tax bill has doubled in the last 6 years, not because of anything I've done, but because of the assessment of my house has gone up. This would be an attempt to allow some way to address that for everybody. And I think that the way a constitutional amendment works, it has to pass 2 years in a row with an election in the middle. So it passed last year. The General Assembly will be reelected in 2009. Hopefully it'll pass again. And then it goes to you all for a vote, and that's when you can decide if you think it's a good idea or not. But I think this is something that it certainly has broad support in the House as currently constructed, and I hope that it'll pass next year and come to you all, I guess, in 2010. Thank you.
The next question is about the big deficit spending. With the big deficit spending now being undertaken by the federal government, how do you think this will affect Virginia in the future, say 3 to 5 years from now?
We always have to pass a balanced budget in Virginia. That's different than the federal government. To the extent that the federal government prints money and spends it, you might not realize this, but it benefits Virginia a lot because we've got a lot of defense industry and a lot of military. And to the extent that the federal government's spending on defense and on military, it's going to help Virginia. Now, does it help the country long term? Well, that remains to be seen. You know, when President Clinton left office, he was generating budget surpluses. That went south pretty fast. And for 8 years, the Congress and the president, frankly, exhibited no fiscal discipline whatsoever. So we had some pretty big deficits. And now with this Congress, those deficits are going to grow higher because I think that many people in the country feel like we have no choice. Either we try to jumpstart the economy, solve the banking crisis, interject some liquidity into the marketplace, or we could face a very, very serious economic future. The short term is what people are talking about right now, but we have to be mindful of the long term. If you look at things like Medicare, Social Security, Medicare, even more prominent than Social Security, those trust funds are running out of money. And when they run out, there's serious, serious implications. And the irony is that people have known this for 15, 20 years, and there's no political will to do anything about it. At least we can identify the problem. Whether we'd have the political will to do anything about it remains to be seen. It probably means two things. I guess I can say this. It probably means some cut in benefits and some increases in taxes. And I don't know how you solve those problems without dealing with those two things. And there's one group of people who doesn't like to cut benefits, and there's another group of people who doesn't like to raise taxes. And so you got the perfect storm to do nothing. So that's my take. Long term, I may be gone by the time the problem really hits, but if you think about it in a global sense, at some point, the dollar starts becoming worthless. And then the Chinese will own the world. And if that's what we want, you know, we got to keep doing things the same way we're doing them.
I always say that the last time Virginia printed money was during the Civil War. That didn't work out so well for us. So, no, Dave's right. The Virginia budget has to be balanced. And so we do bonds, and it's all very, you know, we can set up a bond to build something. But essentially every year we have to match what comes in with what comes out, which is why we have these cuts or growth every year, because we guess what the budget's going to be. But if we don't hit it, when we come into the session in January, all these things you hear about the cuts, that's just us saying, gosh, we projected, I forget what projection was, I think it was 5% growth. We projected 5% growth. That seemed pretty modest. We'd had 10% growth for years. That's a modest growth, and we never hit it. So we had to reduce the budget to meet the revenue that was coming in. I think that in terms of the deficit spending, given the size of the deficit, there's only three ways that we will ultimately deal with this. The first is we will significantly increase taxes on maybe your kids or my kids to pay it off. The second is we default. One day we just decide that it's too much and the country defaults. I hope that that is not a realistic outcome, but certainly some countries have done that. And the third is that we use inflation to take care of it for us. We don't want to do number one. We don't want to raise taxes. We don't want to default. So we just let inflation cut into the size of that debt. In some countries, I'm sure you've read about Argentina, had inflation in hundreds of percent inflation. Well, that's not good either. I mean, especially for anybody on a fixed income. In other words, your income stays the same, but yesterday's value of your dollar is 10% what it was today, and you've all seen pictures of people with wheelbarrows full of money you know, going to the market to try and buy food quickly before their peso or whatever it was got even cheaper. Those are the three choices. Now, I think that the impact will be that it means that the recovery when it comes, and I'm not an economist, but I certainly... They talk to me and I read the newspaper and everything. The recovery when it comes will not be as robust as it would be because we will have a lag from one of these three choices. And again, let's take default off the table. So either we will have to pay higher taxes to pay the money back, or we will use inflation to just shrink the value. Now, Virginia's economy, this is something we're pretty proud of. We are the number one business employer state in the country. We're the most attractive place in the entire country. Sometimes Nevada slips in, sometimes Delaware slips in, but we've always been in the top, not always, we've been in the top five for many years. Right now, we're number one. When the economy turns around, we should be well situated to be first in line. And when people are looking where they want to expand their business or make jobs, we should be in pretty good shape. But we are dependent on the rest of the country. We will be in the first of the line, but wherever that line starts will be where the rest of the country is. And so we're all hopeful that the recovery comes as strongly as it can, and when it does, Virginia will be well situated to take advantage of it. But I do think that the size of this debt is going to cause us significant heartburn down the road.
The next question has to deal with our dependence on fossil fuels. How do you prioritize the need to get away from imported fossil fuels, and should Virginia be taking the lead in some actions related to this?
That's a good one. There's obviously some fossil fuels that we have in abundance, if not in Virginia, although we have a lot of it in Virginia, but at least in nearby states. And, of course, we're talking about coal. One of the good news is that the coal technology has gotten an awful lot better than it used to be. They call it clean coal, but the use of coal, especially to generate electricity, is stronger than it's been. I think that the opportunity to look at offshore, that's our gas. It's Virginian gas, or at least American gas. There's a nuclear power plant at Louisa. We're going to have the first new online nuclear facility in, 20, 30 years now at Lake Anna. And I think we need to keep conservation as part of the puzzle. Every time we save a barrel of oil that was going to be used for power by saving it, it's just like we drilled it somewhere in Alaska. And we can accomplish all of these. I mean, there's... I, I, I agree with those who say that nothing should be off. I mean, let's just keep all of these opportunities on the table. Let's go through them, and if it proves that the natural gas reserves off the shore are not very vast, but the wind is a real opportunity, let's do it. If we can accomplish the same things through conservation, we should do that too. Thank you.
I think this is one of the biggest issues of the next decade, and I think that the legislature is beginning to understand how critical it is. 2 years ago, when Governor Kaine proposed that all public buildings ought to be what they call LEED certified, which LEED is an acronym for energy efficiency in building and generation within a building. When he proposed that, I think a lot of people didn't even understand what it was. But I think in a couple of years, I think a lot of people in the legislature is now beginning to understand. And there was a lot of energy legislation that was on the table for this time around. That being said, you know, there's some politics that gets into the mess here. Governor Kaine had a proposal called Renew Virginia, and it included a number of provisions. And unfortunately, a lot of them were turned down by the House and the majority leadership in the House. And I think that's unfortunate. You know, as Delegate Bell said, we can accomplish a lot with conservation, and the extent to which we provide incentives for people to conserve, it will help us, because if you can save so much in conservation, you obviate the need to build more coal-fired plants or maybe offshore drilling. I mean, you're going to have a lot of things in the mix here. To the legislature's credit, we did pass one piece of legislation that will provide some financial incentive for the utilities to do some work in energy conservation. And in fact, there's going to be some very interesting initiatives in this area having to do with what's called smart grid technology that I think Dominion wants to test out. So watch for that. That'll be very interesting. Long term, we probably have to move away from our voluntary standards for how we generate energy from renewables to one that is a more mandatory standard, where you say to a utility, look, 20% of your portfolio in energy and how you create it, or 25%, has got to be made up with renewables, solar, wind, nuclear, and that's the way it's going to be. And then you set the standard, and then the market takes over, and the market provides the things necessary to meet the standard. Without that, long term, we're going to continue to be sending money to regimes overseas run by people who don't like us. And that's not a good situation to be in.
Hey, Rob.
One thing that I had a bill. It wasn't a big bill, but it was a bill this year, and it was going to be, I was trying to find the title, what we called it, the Clean Energy Foundations Bill. And you might have heard of the Tobacco Settlement Trust Fund. This was the money that came out of the big lawsuit a few years ago, and they are always looking for useful ways to spend money on things that might generate jobs. The problem when it comes to energy is most of the research, if it doesn't have vetting from people, smart people, much smarter than the politicians, you waste it. You use it on technology that has already been proven unsuccessful, or use it on technology where we're 30 years away. And so I had a bill that got out of the House. I think I'm pretty sure Dave supported it, and it got to the Senate. I'm sorry that it died, because what it was going to do is going to set up this foundation. In the Tobacco Settlement Trust Fund, they've said that they will give $100 million, a lot of money, especially in this budget environment, for energy research that is also going to generate jobs. Now, they're not just talking about pie-in-the-sky research like you might get from a think tank, but they said, if you think it'll develop jobs, we will provide the money. All right, that sounds great, but then we talked to UVA and Tech, and they said, well, please, don't just fritter that money away. Don't just throw it out on, again, these dead-end technologies that was tried in Minnesota and won't work, and please don't just use it, again, for something that's it's fusion generation, which is so far off, it's going to be $10 billion, and it just wouldn't make a difference. And it's a shame. I thought, you know, UVA and Tech were very excited about this. They'd already sort of designated which professors and engineering departments they thought would be successful. They have all sorts of neat ideas about how, like solar, slightly better solar cells make huge differences in how useful it can be. And they've got some new paint, and it's way over my head, but they're talking about the ways that a cell can generate more power from the same, two cells side by side in the same sun, same day, one of them generates a lot more power. It makes it much more practical to use. And so I'm sorry that didn't pass. If there's an opportunity to bring it back next year, I will certainly do so. The just so you understand how politics works in Richmond, nobody hated it, but all the other colleges wanted a little something-something to be part of the program. And we had a big argument about it. I said, listen, there's only two of them that do real serious research in this field. It's Tech and UVA. I guess we don't mind if we let everybody else in, but you're going to sort of defeat the whole point of this, which is to have peer review of legitimate programs. This isn't supposed to be pork. It's supposed to be, please, we don't have so much money. It's only $100 million. Can we please keep that for real projects? And the whole thing, we ended up with, I think, George Mason got in, and then a couple of the historically black colleges got in, and at some point there was a long line out the door, and we just couldn't get the votes. That was too bad.
Can I build?
Because I thought that was a really good bill conceptually, and I signed on that bill. So I think there were three of us that actually signed on the bill. He did all the work. So my compliments. I have some ideas for what we might do next year to maybe make it such that we get it passed. You know, there's some politics to go in there. That bill came out of the House and went it over to the democratically controlled Senate. And so there's a little bit of that, and maybe we can work on it next year to improve it. There were a couple other bills. You know, I'd forgotten about this, but Senator Deeds had a bill. It was really an interesting bill. It started out as a bill that would have permitted Charlottesville to create a clean energy incentive program whereby Charlottesville could have lent money to individuals who would invest in solar and other renewables. And it got to a committee, and they changed it into a statewide bill. So now that any locality can do this, they can create that program. That's a great bill. That's a good local control bill. It allows localities, if they want to create a program, they can. They don't have to. It doesn't cost the state any money. It's all up to the locality. It's a great bill. And then I had a little bill, which is called the net metering bill. The concept of net metering is that if you own a solar collector and you put it on your house, and you generate enough electricity to service your own needs through that solar collector, and you generate a little bit of excess, you can sell it back to the utility and get paid. Now, this isn't my great idea. I just took the bill. I've had a couple of net energy bills, and I just bumped up the limit for who could participate. So it made it more available to other people to participate. But it's an example of some things that we can do. Long term, I think we can generate more energy at the local level and sort of fuel the grid with our own local generation. And hopefully that'll help solve some of our problems. It doesn't solve the big ones.
This next question is sort of been answered by your comments on the previous one. This is based on the economy. There is a fourth choice. Invest in growing the gross domestic product by increasing economic activity, particularly in the implementation of new technologies. What will you do to expand the use of those new technologies?
That's a good question. A lot of the research obviously is driven by national. I mean, if we develop something in Virginia that's really smart, it's going to go right to California, right to Oregon, right to Idaho. So obviously some of the research dollars that places like UVA most of the research dollars that places like UVA and Tech are looking at are from national sources, and it probably should be that way. At our level, I've always thought our goal is to make those universities as attractive as they can be for those research grants. And so we have meetings over at UVA all the time, at least once a year. They give us a full top-to-bottom update on what they need. The hospital is not quite on point. The hospital has had some bad luck with people that came in. They reconfigured whole buildings for the person, and then when that one person leaves, he takes with him all of his other experts. And so they've actually moved away from that approach to try and be more flexible about space, because these smart guys, there's only so many smart guys, and they're attractive all over the country. I do think, we talked about this some, that the bill I had, the benefit was it's money. It's $100 million. Now, neither Dave nor I are on the Tobacco Commission, so we couldn't make them do it. But boy, if they're saying, and I can tell you where that came from. They had a feeling that they have a certain amount of money. I think it's a little over $1 billion. And they've been spending it steadily throughout Southside Virginia for years. And I think they had a growing consensus that they weren't going to leave much behind. That as time went on, they were going to spend $1 billion on roofs for buildings and little employers who would come, and then they'd be gone by the time the money ran out. And they said, gosh, let's try and do something that'll stick. let's try and do something so that when we're done with our $1 billion, because they're spending a certain amount every year, when it's done, we want to have something in Southside to take the place of all the tobacco farms that we used to have. That was where it came from. They said, we want to spend $100 million. I think, again, I'm repeating myself, but I think if we're going to spend that kind of money, we really need to make sure that it comes into technology and research that makes sense, so that we can get what the author of that note described. If we do bad technology, if you do dead-end technology, it won't lead to jobs. It'll lead to jobs for a year or two, and then the technology will dead-end, no one will buy it, and that person will lose their job. So I think we need to be careful as we sort of promote technology, we do stuff that makes sense rather than just waste the money.
Rob said something I think is really important, and that is invest in something that will stick. And the problem is that we don't always do that. The other problem is, of course, that we don't have a particularly good track record as the Commonwealth of Virginia in investing in our institutions of higher education who do research. Governor Warner, when he took office, said, look, you know, we got to do a better job. And he set a target, I think it was $1 billion a year in research dollars going to Virginia universities. He couldn't convince the legislature to fund enough of that, but at least he got some of it. And if you want to make sure that you do it right, you invest in good people at universities who can commercialize the research. I mean, the research for the sake of research is nice, but it doesn't create jobs. The University of Virginia has been doing a lot more to commercialize its intellectual activities. And if we can put incentives on the table that link the research dollars with the ability to commercialize them, we'll be doing a lot of good things. If we just invested in the research, it'll be nice. I mean, it'll be great for Charlottesville because we'll have a lot of high-paying professors living here spending their tax dollars on going out to dinner and stuff. But it's not going to create the kind of jobs we really need. And so I hope that as we relook at Delegate Bell's bill from last year, maybe there's some things we can put in there that will encourage commercialization.
Dave said something that's real important. Everyone here is used to being in the town where UVA is located, and we like UVA, and we think that this is sort of everything that's good for UVA is good for the state. Just be aware there's 98 other delegates for whom UVA is not their hometown. And so James Madison is not really, it's more than it used to be, but it's not really a research institution. They train, actually, I think it's bigger than UVA in terms of undergrads. So it is a huge school. A lot of people from Northern Virginia send their kids there. They get a nice college degree, but they only recently have become a grad school at all. Longwood, same thing. Christopher Newport, same thing. ODU has some research. George Mason is getting more research than it used to. But, you know, we just happen to live where the premier research institution in the state is. In fact, one of the premier ones in the country. That's the tension. Some of these other when we're looking at higher education dollars, people from Harrisonburg, they just want money for JMU. To heck with research. They say, we are educating more kids than UVA. Why don't we get more money than UVA? And so that's, I think that what Dave said is exactly right. We need to make sure that when the time comes to propose research and things like that, that's something we keep an eye on.
This next question is about the next legislative year. What will be the two key issues in this next legislative year, and what is your position on these?
I mean, I think that it's going to be the economy, I mean, not to be funny, but the economy and the economy, at least at first. If the economy doesn't turn around, if the news we got, so let's take what Dave said earlier, that the federal stimulus money that came down allowed Virginia to patch a hole in last year's budget, sort of paper over a two-month shortfall, which is what it did. If we don't see a turnaround, there's not going to be much of a new proposal. The new proposals are going to be very, very limited because there just won't be any money. In fact, what we'll be doing is what we looked at doing this year, which is find the ones that you like best and preserve them, and the rest of them are going to have a hard time. So I think that the real issue is going to be, how does the economy come back? I think that and we might take different approaches to it, but I think most of the General Assembly would say that we need to do everything we can to promote the recovery, make sure that as the country's economy, we all hope, sort of turns around again, that Virginia stands first in line to take benefit from that. Not all the states are going to recover at the same rates. You look at, gosh, California, Michigan, Ohio, even when the country comes around, there's reason to think they are going to be very, very slow to get their unemployment down. We are hopeful that Virginia's, again, we were first in line when this all started to go bad. We'll be first in line as it recovers. Hopefully people will find jobs here. Now, ultimately, that means people will probably move here from Michigan. But at least in the short run, that I think that's going to be the priority for the next year.
If you take the snapshot today, it's clearly going to be the budget. Now, who knows what things are going to look like at the end of August, early September. And, of course, we got this little thing called an election where a new governor is going to be elected and he will have priorities that he's going to put on the table, and that's going to determine a lot of what the legislative session is about. You know, you might see some efforts in the area of transportation. I don't know. But I think it really is going to be about the budget. I think there'll be a subset. A big issue coming is the re-benchmarking of the standards of quality for education. This happens every 2 years. The standards of quality are the standards that the state sets for what has to happen in K-12 education. The re-benchmarking is a process by which the state tries to put a price tag attached to those standards. Now, localities can always go above the standards, and Charlottesville and Albemarle do that, but it's the baseline. And the projection is that that re-benchmarking is likely to be another $1 billion in the next budget. And that's a tremendous amount of money at a time where you don't have expanding tax revenue. So something's got to give. And, you know, we probably will have some increase in tax revenue, but will it be enough to get you to $1 billion extra? Who knows? And there have been fights in the past. There'll probably be a fight again next time around on that issue.
The next question is about our state school system. Do you think our state schools of higher education should be required to accept a larger number of in-state students?
No. It's pretty simple. I mean, I guess it's not as simple as a no, but you know, the University of Virginia does a great job in a couple of things. One is we're a world-class institution, and one of the reasons we're world-class is that we got lots of people from the world, not just West Virginia, North Carolina, New York, but China, Singapore, India. This enriches the university, enriches us, it enriches Virginia. A lot of these people stay here, and they help complement the brain power that we have that's going to help our society compete in the world economy. I understand the consternation of a lot of people. I've got an 11-year-old. He's pretty smart. He wants to go to the University of Virginia. I don't want him kept out because some out-of-state student takes his spot. But I also recognize, from the point of view of the state as a whole, that it's probably better to allow everybody to compete. And also realizes that out-of-state students help pay the tuition of in-state students and help support, and we've got this program at UVA called Access UVA that allows kids who may not be able to afford to go to school to essentially have their way paid. So we're doing a lot of good things at the University of Virginia, and I don't think we should mess it up with quotas. I mean, why quotas? People don't like quotas. Why should we impose it to allow in-state students beyond a certain level? We've got a good target number now. I think it's, what, 70% in-state? Is that what it is? Yeah, it's pretty close to 70%. That's pretty good. Let's keep where it is.
We had a proposal this year that I thought was probably a pretty fair compromise for this. And what happens is each year, let's take a step back. Schools' policies, for the most part, are set by their Board of Visitors. They are separated from the General Assembly because somewhere along the way people said politicians do a lousy job of running colleges. Let's let them pick people to run the colleges but not get down into the nitty-gritty. That said, we do what we're allowed to change anything we want. We can pass a law. Virginia schools are growing. Some of them are growing explosively. UVA is not. It's growing at a much smaller rate, sort of steadily adding, I think it's like 100 students a year or something like that. And then other schools like George Mason have exploded. Oh, my goodness, 35,000 students, undergrads, up at George Mason. It's more than double the size of UVA. James Madison has grown a lot. What they said was, why don't we say that as you grow, you have to take a certain percentage of the new of in-state kids as you grow. So we're not going to change the overall student population that you've had for 200 years, but we are going to say, as Virginia provides support for these additional kids, you have to take a percentage. I thought that was a pretty fair compromise. The House passed that, I think, as part of its budget, but I ultimately don't think it passed, though. My memory is it died in conference.
I think it actually died.
Yeah, I do too. My memory is Dave and I both voted for that as a way to say we recognize that taxpayers are paying for these schools. And I do think that the question at UVA, where you want to keep it a world-class institution and have a lot of smart kids from other states come in, is one thing. I do think that we need to make sure there is a spot for every kid who wants to go. So it may not be that he gets into UVA, but I mean, we have, 14 or 15 state institutions. There ought to be a spot for every kid from Virginia who grew up here who wants to go to a four-year school. Now, for budget reasons, many of them are now starting at two-year schools like PVCC for 2 years and then transferring over, and that's a sort of a separate issue. UVA has been very generous with allowing those kids to come in.
This next question has to do with the census. After the census in 2010, all political districts will be redrawn. Will you support a nonpartisan commission to do the redistricting?
I would be happy to have input from any such commission. I don't think we should give them the power to draw the lines without having us do it. I think that we're responsible for those lines at the end of the day. I will say this, and I've said this to the League of Women Voters, for whom this has been an issue they've had for some time. The technology has reached a point now where you can give us your suggestions. Now, that may sound bizarre. It used to be in a line, a dark room with chalkboards. Now you can get the computer program and draw your own lines and present them to us. I would, if I'm in a position to do this, I don't know. There usually are only a handful of guys that do this. But if I'm in a position, I would be happy to take input from a nonpartisan commission or from anybody in this room about how they'd like to see both our regional lines drawn. Because David and I could, it's basically Rio Road. I could show you where our lines split. He has everything toward the city on Rio, and I've got everything north. If you don't like that line, tell us. I don't know that we'll be able to change it, but at least tell us. And then I'd be happy to hear more general comments about how the state should draw its lines. Thank you.
I've generally supported the nonpartisan redistricting proposals. I think that generally speaking, the rule is supposed to be that constituents choose their elected leaders, and unfortunately, with the sophistication of the technology, it's becoming increasingly the case that elected leaders choose their constituents, and I'm not sure that's a good idea. Now, I don't know, are you still on P&E, Privileges and Elections?
I'm on a different side.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, he's fortunate enough to be on the committee that eventually the bill, and this will be a bill on redistricting, goes through, even though his subcommittee won't look at it, I guess. So he has the opportunity to put the both of us in the same district if he wants to, if they're still in the majority then. We'll relish that. Then that way we can have a lot of fun. We actually can have an electoral contest as opposed to just coming here and talking. But I support the Creed Eads had a bill. I signed on that bill a couple of years ago. I've supported the bill. It's gotten out of the Senate, hadn't gotten anywhere in the House. We'll have to see what happens next time around.
The last question, which really pertained to the previous question, was about ending gerrymandering and what standard should define the better districts. Do you think you've sufficiently answered that with your previous comments?
Technical, if you want.
Yeah, I mean, there's...
In the weeds.
I mean, there's something called compactness, which means how closely packed it in. There's something called contiguity, which means the district has to all touch each other. You can't sort of jump over a river and run down a road. There's questions about whether it should be community of interest or county boundaries. What I mean is I have four counties in my district, which sounds terrible, except actually Orange County is not a sensible way to draw a district. Barboursville has a lot more in common with Green than it has with Fredericksburg. Orange is it's a long county. So almost all of my constituents live in the country or the suburbs, but they work in town. That's a pretty sensible community of interests. Green County has a lot in common with Fluvanna County. But on a map, it looks terrible. Now, the other way you could do it was you could give me all of Albemarle County, but some parts of it look like the city. I don't know. That's the difference.
Where'd I go?
Oh, you'd have the city. I mean, obviously. There's a question about how competitive you want to be. And what I mean is if your only issue is making it competitive, you have to do something to a place like the city. The city of Charlottesville, it's no big secret, is a Democratic bastion, and it typically votes 70-80% for the Democrats. If you ever want to make that a competitive place, it's called pizza slicing. What that means is you go in and grab a little piece of the city, and you draw all the way out into the country, so each district looks like a slice of pizza. That's the only way you would ever make the city a competitive environment, because you'd have to go all the way out to Greene and Augusta County to get enough Republicans to balance the way the city usually votes. Those maps would be very competitive, but they would look worse than the maps we have now, actually. And so those are some of the issues that come up with gerrymandering and redistricting. I'll say this. Right now, the House is controlled by Republicans. The Senate is controlled by Democrats. Historically, and I'm not going to say anything about all the House Democrats who say they're all for a bipartisan redistricting plan, but historically what happens is if one side controls both parts, that's pretty much who decides how the redistricting goes. Right now you're going to see some bipartisanship just because the Senate will have its bill and the House will have its bill and has to pass both bodies. I don't know if that's more information than you needed or down in the weeds like Dave said.
Yeah, and if you look at these districts, my guess is that neither Delegate Bell's or my district changes very much at the end of the day. Well, both of ours have gotten more population in it. I mean, the district where you see a change is probably Cree Deeds district. That is the weirdest looking district, and that district's going to most likely change. The other place where you're going to see a lot of change is probably in the congressional districts. I mean, the Periello district could change really dramatically if the Democrats have control of the governor's mansion or the House, because they're going to want to try to draw that district to make it a little more favorable to Tom. So, and that's how the game is played, at least right now.
I want to thank all of the people for your questions. They were very astute and well-timed. I want to urge you, if you are just a member, to thank you for coming and make sure your membership is renewed. And if you're a guest, consider joining our group. It only costs $15 for a year to support this endeavor. And I want to give a special thanks to David Toscano and Rob Bell for taking their time out of a busy schedule to come here and give us this information, which has been very well received. Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.